Penguin Random House Audio presents Time of the Magicians. Wittgenstein, Benjamin, Cassirer, Heidegger, and the Decade That Reinvented Philosophy. By Wolfram Eilenberger. Translated by Sean Whiteside. Read for you by Rhett Samuel Price. The best that we have from history is the enthusiasm that it stimulates. Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, Maxims and Reflections. 1. Prologue. The Magicians. The Arrival of God.
Don't worry. I know you'll never understand it.
This sentence concluded what was probably the most peculiar oral exam in the history of philosophy. Appearing for his doctoral examination at Cambridge on June 18, 1929, before a panel consisting of Bertrand Russell and G.E. Moore, was a 40-year-old former multimillionaire from Austria who had, for the previous 10 years, been working chiefly as a primary school teacher. His name was Ludwig Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein wasn't some obscure returning Cambridge student. On the contrary, from 1911 until just before the outbreak of the First World War, he had studied there with Russell and had quickly become a cult figure, known for both his obvious brilliance and his waywardness. "Well, God has arrived. I met him on the 5:15 train," John Maynard Keynes wrote in a letter dated January 18, 1929. Keynes, at the time probably the most important economist in the world, met Wittgenstein by chance the day after his return to England. It says a great deal about the intimate, rumor-filled atmosphere of university life at the time that Wittgenstein's old friend, G.E. Moore, was on the same train from London to Cambridge. But it would be a mistake to think that the atmosphere in the compartment was entirely convivial. Wittgenstein at least was not given to small talk or other social niceties. The genius from Vienna was prone to sudden outbursts of fury and could be extremely unforgiving. A single word out of place or jocular observation could lead to years of rancor, indeed to a breakdown in relations, as had happened several times with Keynes and Moore. However, God was back, and accordingly, joy was unconfined. The next day, a meeting of the apostles, a highly elitist unofficial students' club notorious at the university for the sexual proclivities of its members, was called in Keynes's house to welcome the prodigal son. At a ceremonial dinner, Wittgenstein was promoted to the rank of angel, an honorary senior member of the society. Most of the group's members hadn't met for more than a decade. A lot had happened in the meantime, but to the apostles, Wittgenstein appeared almost unchanged. It wasn't just that he was wearing his typical outfit of an open-necked shirt, gray flannel trousers, and heavy agricultural-looking boots. Physically, too, the years seemed to have passed without leaving a trace. At first sight, he looked like one of the gifted students who had also been invited, and who had previously known the strange man from Austria only from their professors' stories. And, of course, that he was the author of the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, the legendary work that had shaped, if not actually dominated, philosophical discussion in Cambridge for several years. None of those present would have claimed that they had even begun to understand the book, but this fact only boosted its fascination. Wittgenstein had finished the book in 1918 as a prisoner of war in Italy, convinced that he had found the solution to philosophical questions on all essential points, and thus decided to turn his back on the discipline. Only a few months later, as the heir to one of the wealthiest industrial families in Europe, he transferred his entire inheritance to his siblings. As he told Russell in a letter at the time, "From now on, plagued as he was by severe depression and thoughts of suicide, he would support himself with honest toil. he would become a teacher at a provincial primary school. Wittgenstein was back in Cambridge, back, it was said, to philosophize. The genius, now 40 years old, had no academic title and was utterly penniless. The little money that he had managed to save lasted only a few weeks in England. Cautious inquiries about the willingness of his siblings to help him out financially were intemperately dismissed. "Will you please accept my written declaration that not only I have a number of wealthy relations, but also that they would give me money if I asked them to, but that I will not ask them for a penny," Wittgenstein wrote to Moore the day before his oral examination. What was to be done? No one in Cambridge doubted Wittgenstein's exceptional gifts. Everyone, including the most influential figures at the university, wanted to keep him there. But without an academic title, it proved institutionally impossible to find a research grant, let alone a regular teaching post for the former dropout, even in the clubby atmosphere of Cambridge. In the end, they hatched a plan. Wittgenstein would submit the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, his first and so far his only book, as a doctoral thesis. Russell had personally advocated for its publication in 1921 through 1922, and had written a foreword to help the process along, since he considered the work of his former pupil far superior to his own groundbreaking studies in the philosophy of logic, mathematics, and language. No wonder, then, that upon entering the examination room, Russell swore that he had never known anything so absurd in my life. Still, an exam is an exam. And after a few minutes of friendly inquiry, Moore and Russell started asking some serious questions. These concerned one of the central riddles of the Tractatus, a book not exactly short on opaque aphorisms and mystical one-liners. Take, for example, the very first sentence of the work, strictly organized according to a decimal system. 1. The world is everything that is the case. Take also entries like 6.432. How the world is completely indifferent for what is higher. God does not reveal himself in the world. Or 6.44. Not how the world is the mystical, but that it is. The fundamental impulse behind the book is nonetheless clear. Wittgenstein's Tractatus stands in a long tradition of modern philosophy, such as Spinoza's Ethics, Hume's An Inquiry into Human Understanding, and Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. All of these attempt to draw a boundary between the propositions in our language, which are truly meaningful and thus capable of truth, and those that only seem meaningful, and because of that very illusoriness, lead our thought and culture astray. In other words, the Tractatus is a therapeutic contribution to the question of what one can meaningfully talk about as a human being and what one cannot. It is no coincidence that the book ends with the aphorism, 7. Whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must remain silent. And just before that, under entry 6.54, Wittgenstein reveals his own therapeutic method. My propositions are elucidatory in this way. He who understands me finally recognizes them as senseless, when he has climbed out through them, on them, over them. He must, so to speak, throw away the ladder after he has climbed upon it. He must surmount these propositions. Then he sees the world rightly. In the oral examination, Russell now focused on this very point. How precisely was that to happen? How can someone be helped through a sequence of nonsense propositions to the correct vision of the world? Had Wittgenstein not expressly said in the preface to his book that the truth of the thoughts communicated here seems to him to be unassailable and definitive? How could that be so if the work, by the author's own account, consisted almost entirely.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?